So, Beauty and the Beast. I'll let you guess which one of us is which. Who knows, right? I was reminded in pre-talk by everybody. Beauty is everywhere. Beauty is everywhere. Beauty is wondrous. It's everywhere. But then Valerie got up here with that T-shirt, so I don't. That's terrible. I apologize, but I asked her ahead of time if I could do that. And as a good sport and somebody with a great sense of humor, she said yes. And then she took my line and used it against me earlier. So what I see is a growing feud here that could amp up in all kinds of interesting ways. So we'll find out. The title is Beauty is Subjectively Objective, Why It is Ordinarily Extraordinary. My dear wife looked at me and said, why are you doing that? People at C3 have always been so nice to you. Why are you inflicting that title on them? I said, no, this is great. This is great. One, it's what I mean, and I'll explain it. And two, this will kind of separate folks out, frankly. You know? This is like organic chemistry, you know? And we'll see who the serious people are. We'll find out. So I have a lot to say. It's a little hit or miss. I might be going back and forth with my notes here a little bit. So if I were you, I'd cancel your lunch plans. We're going to be here a while. Do you know the Lyle Lovett song, Church? Anybody familiar with that? Such a wonderful song, right? Church is just going on all day. They had to like mount an insurrection from the choir to get the preacher to stop. I'm not going to do that. All right, let's start with what I've got here. I brought the kitchen sink. All right, so I think you have to start, philosophers have to start with not only definitions, but some distinctions. And what's the most perennial question about art and beauty, especially in at least the Western tradition? And by the way, maybe I should apologize for this, but I'm going to speak from a classical Western philosophical perspective. I know that there are other perspectives. I just don't have time in the 46 minutes I have to bring all of those other indigenous and other perspectives to bear, but part two is always on the offing. But here's, first of all, it's subjective, it's objective. As I said in the notes to this that were in the email you got, one response to that could be, who cares? Being around beauty is just, it's pleasurable. Isn't that enough? No, it's not for me. Therefore, it's not enough for you for the next 20 minutes. Think of just one consequence of how we answer that question, whether it's subjective or object. If you start from 50,000 years ago, in terms of what we know about ways in which people were using makeup, all the way to the current fashion industry, it makes a difference whether people are thinking of this subjectively or objectively. If there's an objective standard of beauty, then we should be able to figure it out and more or less conform to it and sell products and procedures that get people more or less towards that standard. And if they deviate from that standard willingly by not availing themselves of all the cosmetics and surgeries and everything else that's out there and gym memberships, well, then that's their fault. Whatever the carrying costs of being, you know, whatever you are, not as beautiful as you could be, that's on you. Interestingly, the carrying costs of being beautiful are also quite high, and we'll talk about that in a second. But at the very least, that the history of relationships between men and women, the history of aesthetics as men and women for mating purposes have been expressed, largely mating purposes, is consequential. Not to mention, you know, an entire history of censorious behavior. The expression of the beautiful has been, you know, highly curtailed. Who knows how many artists we lost and how much expression of beauty we might have lost over the years because of somebody's objection to its corrupting or corruptible nature. I'm going to speak largely of the beauty of beauty and conform myself to art, but I also want to get one other thing out there right away, and that is, you know, there's a dark side to beauty. There's a madness that beauty evokes, can evoke in people. Dorian Gray, Narcissus, the Virgin Suicides, I mean, we could go on, right? There are lots of folks. I mean, there are actually in the DMS, there are actual psychiatric disorders that are revolve around obsession with beauty. Either your own dysmorphia, trying to become beautiful in a crazy kind of way, or being so obsessed with beauty, usually in the form of another person, that you do things that you should not do. So it's subjective in the sense that we have a subjective response to it. It's objective. It actually inheres in reality because it's evolutionarily selected for. You were wondering when I was going to get to science. I know. Here we are. We'll get to it a little more later. But there's a kind of, you probably heard of the golden section, the golden ratio, proportionality, symmetry, the perfect or ideal form, ways in which the parts cohere to make it greater than the sum of the parts. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Eyes set apart, skin tone, hair thickness, hip to waist ratio. There are so many elements that go into this. And depending upon your point of view, it was either selected for the same way that things like fear and other emotions were selected for to help survival, or was selected as kind of an outgrowth. It's a secondary characteristic. Here's Steven Pinker, the great Harvard psychologist on this. I believe that art is a byproduct of three adaptations: the hunger for status, the aesthetic pleasure of experience, adaptive objects and environments, and the ability to design artifacts to achieve desired ends. And again, in history, we know right from the get-go, as soon as people had, somebody mentioned this morning, a little bit of time on their hands, were creating things to use as tools, they're also looking for ways to decorate them and ways to make them look, you know, attractive in some way. One other thing I got to mention, because it goes into this next story. We get pleasure from things that promote the fitness, such as the taste of food, the experience of sex, the presence of children. I don't know about that one, but all right. The attainment of know-how, sorry. As people explore an environment, they seek patterns that help them negotiate it and take advantage of its contents. The patterns include well-delineated regions and probable but informative features like parallel and perpendicular lines, axes of symmetry and elongation. All are used by the brain to carve the visual field into surfaces, and then there's a corollary with that with the auditory as well, to see patterns and make recognitions. So here's an example of maybe how all this comes: symmetry, harmony, skin color, skin tone, the ratio of hip to waist. I mean, all the sort of things that evolution seems to have selected as beautiful. So young woman shows up in my classroom many, many years ago, and consciously, right, think, well, that's an attractive person. Subconsciously, so say the scientist, I'm going through all these variations in terms of hip to waist ratio, right? Huh? You know, hair color? Huh? A kind of color in the face that suggests that she's maybe not suffering from parasites. Really, I mean, that's part of the vestigial thinking that we've got from an evolution point of view about what makes somebody beautiful. Well, that somebody turns out to be my now wife, Mandy, who elicits a strong subjective response, but also an objective response, not just to me, but I assure you and others as well, in which people are responding to the same kinds of features, hardwired to do it. So we go out for our first date, and we double down on beauty. We go to the symphony, partly because I'm pretentious, partly because, you know, if you are looking to steep yourself in beauty, if beauty is the thing that brings one to love, and if love, as Diotimus says to Socrates, is a kind of longing, it's a hunger, it's an absence that seeks to fulfill itself in meaning, not only are we hopefully finding each other physically attractive in ways that we're both conscious and unconscious of, but now we want to double down on the experience of beauty itself, to wrap ourselves in it, to steep ourselves in it. So the first experience is music. It's gorgeous. I don't remember who it was, but it was beautiful. Second one, and it's her suggestion, let's go to what was at that time the old Grand Rapids Art Museum. So we're really doubling down. It's like just nothing art and nothing but art. That's all we got going for us. Right? But as we're doing that at this, again, sub or unconscious level, part of what we're trying to communicate to one another, I think, is, you know, do we share the same sorts of sensibilities around the ways that we see the visual and auditory world? Do we experience the same kinds of things and the things inherent in classical music or the art we're looking at as inherently, realistically, objectively beautiful? And are we having similar, same kinds of subjective responses to those things? Does that make sense? That's really what I mean by the title, which is, and here's a line that will help, I think, crystallize that, I hope. If beauty is entirely subjective, that is, if anything that anyone holds to be or experiences as beautiful is beautiful, then it seems that the word has no meaning. Well, let me take issue with this author for a second, because it seems to me there are two ways you can go on the subjectivity. One, everything's beautiful, everything's beautiful, oh my God, you're so beautiful. It does kind of wear it out, and you wonder in the end what's really beautiful. What that kind of beauty means, I think, is just, all right, there's a sense of personal approval. I like this, it's pleasing to me, but I think that probably has more to do with taste than it has to do with what I would consider a more profound encounter with beauty itself. And taste is important. We are, again, hardwired to make judgments about one another. The British philosopher Mary Midgley said, it would be very odd if we'd gotten to this point in human evolution and then willingly or willfully gave up the thing that makes us able to survive as well as we do, and that is discernment and judgment. Right now, some of you have judgment about these boots. I know you do. Okay? You know who you are. We have to, and we're wired to. It's our environment. We have to pay attention to it and respond to it. So that's one part of, is everything beautiful? I don't know. I mean, I'm a middle child, so there's a part of me that, well, yes, that could be, you know, it's all possible. I mean, I sort of get the argument for it. At the same time, the mind that's trained in philosophy says, I don't think so. I think there are things that adhere both in objective reality and in our subjective response, and that can be educated for, right? It's sort of like wine, if I can use that parallel. It's like, well, people say, well, you like what you like. That's great. Well, maybe, maybe not. Have you tried this? Have you seen it this way? I don't know if it was Whistler or Sartre. I think it was Whistler, where somebody came to him and said, well, I've never seen anything, you know, the way you painted that. And he looked at her and he said, I know, but don't you wish you could? Don't you wish you could? That's my job, is to help you see it in ways that otherwise you wouldn't be able to. That's educative. I'll tell you a short story about that. I may have told the story before here, but it was probably forever ago, as Valerie pointed out. I was consulting with a company, and this is going to sound pretentious as hell, but this is only because it was. And they wanted their upcoming managers to be, frankly, more cultured. They were nice people and they were smart people, but the family that owned the business was highly cultured, and they said, well, it's, you know, these people are going to be the face of the business. They really got to, you know, kind of step up their game in terms of some of the cultural niceties that our clients and customers are going to expect. And they came to me and said, well, said money really is no object. Why don't you take them to Chicago for a weekend and, like, you know, give them some culture. That's such a trap, right? I mean, that's a recipe for disaster if anybody gets... And imagine yourself as one of these up-and-coming managers. It's like, well, turnip truck, faller offer. We're going to take you to Chicago to, you know, bump up your, you know, cultural, you know, education a bit. Nonetheless, they were all good sports. We went. We spent a ton of money. We saw Hamlet, and we, you know... went out for a very nice dinner and had the chef explain everything, and we did this and we did that. And I know enough about art to be dangerous, but I thought, you know, for something like this, for going to the Art Institute, really need to get an art historian. So I called UC, and we got a very nice art historian. And we were there. We planned to be there 2.5 hours, and she was going to show us 5 paintings and really do a kind of in-depth, you know, on each painting. And honest to God, I mean, the owners of this company weren't entirely wrong. 3 of these people had never been inside a museum in their lives. So there was an opportunity here, played right. And fortunately, she was great. And she really went through the story, and she went through the artist, and she went through pigmentation. You know, why would you use this kind of brush or that? And the levels of seeing that she, you know, introduced us to, got to a point where I, you know, not in a million years could I have written this and hoped it worked out this way. But they sort of come in, you know, they came in kind of grudgingly. Oh, museums! I'm so bored already. Like 12-year-olds, right? It's like, when do we eat? You know. instead, what happened? Because of her ability to bring that art to life, and she was so smart—only 5 paintings in all of the AI's collection. We were there 4 hours. They didn't want to leave. They got it. You know, they didn't have someone like me banging them over the head. She's just very matter-of-factly. This is the beauty I see. This is how to see it if you're looking for it. And whatever kind of emotional response you're having, that's great. So there are ways to educate and train that emotional response as well, to bring that to life in a deeper appreciation. I mean, I don't know why we would educate anybody anyway if we didn't presume that you could be educated to appreciate fine wine, fine art, music in ways that we might not otherwise, right? There's an old Zen koan, first there's a mountain, then there's no mountain, then there's a mountain. And it's sometimes used in contexts like this to say, you know, we just sort of experience the world more or less blindly or more or less emotionally. And we've got whatever response we have to the color and the light, et cetera. And then we go on and we get a little more educated and we understand what the sculpture, what the artist is trying to do, what he or she is doing. And our world becomes richer and broader, more nuanced, I think, more layered, more textured because of that. In terms of the, so just to wrap up the subject object, in case we lost the thread, subjective responses to objectively inherent phenomenon. And think about, we talked about this a little bit in pre-talk, think about how we vote with our feet. This is the phrase that I used in pre-talk, because anything could be beautiful to anybody under any circumstances. And again, I get that from a sort of mystical or spiritual or a transitioning of the world to you know, the Tibetans, for example, in my own tradition, it's like they're forever taking gross and ugly substances and asking you to transform them in your head to make them beautiful, to get over the duality and the repugnancy and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, there is this notion, too, that if certain things adhere, they end up... Oops, I'll go to the next one. No, I don't want to do that yet. Yeah, I will. While they have different cultural expressions in different times, we show up for, we put on the walls, we go to the exhibits, we go to Symphony Hall to see a version of more or less the same thing, right? And you may say, well, that's, where's the innovation in that? Where's the, but think about it, all right? I don't know how many of you are subscribers to the Grand Rapids or Chicago Symphony, and what do they do on a regular basis? And Dick brought this up. He said, you know, it was Itzhak Perlman played a really atonal piece, you know, I don't know where you saw him, but, and symphonies do that now. They give themselves one piece, maybe every 2 or 3 performances. Okay, this is kind of for us. You know, we're going to do Shostakovich. We know nobody likes him, really. But we'll do it for us because it's fun and it's challenging. And it's, you know, the musicians, it's a certain amount of bebop and jazz. I like, but I don't like it for hours. Right? But the musicians love it because there's a kind of free jazz expression of that is very, very fun to play. We don't gravitate towards that. Every year, it's some variation of Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, Chopin. It is. And, it's the pre-talk, if you're a museum curator or director and the coffers are getting a little low, what's your go-to exhibit? You call up the Louvre, you call up the Met, you call up and you say, we need your Impressionist paintings. Please give them to us. And we will put on an exhibit and people will line up for days to go and see it. Why? Because we're all kind of responding more or less to the same things. Now, there's a lot of controversy about the golden ratio. You may have heard of that. Golden section has to do with proportionality and the ratio of the parts of any kind of object or person. The general thinking at the moment is actually what we find most beautiful is the best of the average. We all are familiar with average faces, and in our mind, the composite of the best of the average is what we consider to be beautiful. Because there's such variation, that's what we're looking for. We find it in nature and architecture and art. Think of fractals or those tiny little particles that are self-similar and build up. Everything from the human body to Indian, you know, Vishnu Vaishnava temples built on this notion of sort of self-similar. They're the building blocks of the universe. We are hardwired because we're part of the universe to respond to things that mirror reality, both in its complexity and in its simplicity. And we find that and call that beautiful more than we find or call anything else beautiful. So much of modern and postmodern art was a rejection of that. I mean, if everything was beautiful and everything was an attempt to realize an ideal, there's the best example I can think of, pretty much through human history, for various reasons, including World War I and the ugliness of that, at least in the Western world, the artist said, enough of that, you know? Beauty is a fool's game, and it has led to nothing but death and destruction. We're turning our back on that. I might butcher the quote here. I've got a picture from Picasso later, but Picasso maybe most famously sums that up by saying, I recoil in horror when people want to talk to me about beauty. I have no idea what it means. The only thing that interests me is the problem of painting. But on the other hand, it was Picasso. How ironic he was being, I have no idea. Here's a story about, I don't know if you've had the privilege or pleasure of being there. Here's another function of art that I think that David brought out in me that maybe I hadn't when I was 18 or 19 when I first saw it, that maybe I certainly had not fully realized to that point. And that is, art brings you to the limits of human experience and then breaks it. Right? What true genius does on this telling, true art, beautiful art does, it brings you to the very limits of what you think is possible to imagine, to experience, to feel as a human, and breaks it. It transports you. It is the spiritual element for so much of who we are and what we do. Think about the kind of rituals that are, you know, everywhere in every culture. People don't just give you a list of rules. You know, the Christians, Easter Sunday, did not just say, hey, here's a list of rules, follow those. And what do? They wrapped it in the most magnificent art and music one could argue the world has ever known. It's like, I gave a talk explaining, you know, certain Buddhist tenets, and it was with a panel with a Christian. And I said, look, you know, I got to give you this. He said, the art, the architecture, the music, you got us. It's all over. We're not even trying. It's just magnificent. You had all the best people playing for you. It doesn't matter. It's like a team of all-stars, right? It's incredible. And so you're in there, and you're looking at this, and there's an old story. There's some truth to it. I wish it was truer than it is. A young man, an artist, who goes in, and if you've been to Italy, you know there's a certain laxity to security, let's call it that. They're not always on top of everything. Anyway, this is about 20 years ago, and a guy went in a hammer, and he was busted off the left toe of the David before onlookers were able to grab him and grapple him to the ground. And the initial story, which is the one I like the most, it's a romanization, is he was driven mad by the beauty of it. This was beyond what human beings should be able to do, should be able to imagine. I mean, think of William Blake, think of Rembrandt. I love that quote that I put on the bulletin. It's the shadow of the gods, you know, whatever the gods mean to you. Coming in to, I mean, I can't do this. I mean, maybe you can. I'm guessing you can't do that. You wouldn't be here. You'd be doing something else. You'd be home making this thing, right? Very, very few humans can do anything like this, and it moves us to a point where we start thinking about, all right, what might be possible to imagine, to feel, and to relate to. So it turns out that this guy actually was just truly mentally unstable. He'd been mad before he saw the David, which disappointed me, strangely, because even though I don't want to do any harm to art, I actually kind of get why. That could drive you crazy. This is Vermeer, the letter reader in blue. You're talking about the experience of beauty in the ordinary. Here's why I subtitled it, the ordinarily extraordinary. from my point of view, and of course there's always going to be room for argument in aesthetics, but again, I can't do this, you can't do this, no one could do this except Vermeer. And there's some controversy about whether even Vermeer could do it, right? Whether he was using some sort of proto camera. But anyway, here's something, what could be more ordinary after centuries of mythology and biblical epics, right? Then this Dutch woman, apparently pregnant, reading a letter by the window. Why is this hanging in a museum? Why are we all so struck? Why do we line up? If you can't get the Impressionists, get the Dutch masters. If you can't get the Dutch masters, get Dali or Picasso, go from there. Because nobody ever seen color, light, proportion in service of an ordinary event quite like this ever before. And we all went, wow, this is the evolution of seeing. This is the evolution of feeling in response to a piece of art. Now, it wasn't all, well, first, I've been talking about the Impressionists, so you'll recognize that, of course, as one of Monet's haystacks. Why is it beautiful? What does it evoke in us? Why do all of us want to go? There's a fringe element of folks, educated at places like Berkeley who will turn their backs on this, but, we don't care about them, so. It wasn't all beauty in the service of beauty. So this is Goya, the black paintings from the 1820s and 30s, never meant to be public. He painted these on the walls of his house, and they were transferred to canvas after this Saturn devouring his son. There's another earlier version of this that by another artist that Goya probably was familiar with. This one is putting the madness into the art, right? Not waiting for the response of it makes us mad. I just say this without, I might sound pretentious, sorry. I had a conference in Spain a couple weeks ago. It was in Valencia, very nice. But you're about 2 hours from the Prado there, and Mandy said, okay, look, I know this conference is really important to you, but I'm going up to Madrid for the day. Said, you can stay in the stuffy basement of a Holiday Inn in Valencia, Spain, if you want to. I said, or you can come. I wasn't presenting that day. I went. The Prado has an entire room devoted to Goya's black paintings. And I don't know that I've been this affected by art in a while. Again, the horror, the madness of war was happening in Spain, whether it was, some critics just a representation of, the myth, whatever it was, you're confronted again with what the genius of particular artists can do. And it makes me think of beauty, again, as a form of elevation, of a form of introduction to the spiritual, as a form of ethical instruction in terms of cautionary tales, but also as a kind of liberation from norms, from a way of seeing or feeling that even if it's for a few minutes in a room full of, a bunch of other German tourists, I can escape myself and be transported by. Interestingly, as we move along in notions of beauty, we leave realism and we get a kind of elongated, in Modigliani, we get a kind of, I don't mean to replicate your junior year art history class, sorry, but it's so fascinating. So why do we find this beautiful too? And it seems on the surface very different than the classical notions. And again, historians, evolutionary psychologists, philosophers are going to look at this and say, no, the proportionality is still so similar to what you would find as a through line. So there is a reason these are chosen. It's not an arbitrary game in which just the elites are deciding, well, we'll throw this on the wall and keep this in the dustbin of history. We all, again, are responding, or most of us, to what Modigliani is doing here in terms of the stylization of beauty, the way he's presenting beauty, again, in a way that we might not have seen or thought about before, and yet still true to scientific principles. Now, Picasso throws that out the window, more or less, you think, except it's instructive. Now, whether it's beautiful or not, you could argue. I would say it's a stretch for me to admit that the Picassos are beautiful, but I'm drawn to them anyway. Why? I think this goes back to the notion of the fractals. There's something about the way he's representing the world that nobody else got that still is mirroring a sense of ourselves and nature in the way that we experience ourselves when we're not, frankly, as put together as we might be. And with just a couple of references to music, the A major is interesting because the second movement, the Allegretto, the one that's the most famous, switches to A minor, and so you've got sort of chordal tension between those, and it's the one everybody plays. In fact, it was so famous, it became so popular so fast, people responded to it, including the critics, so well that they asked, when some of the other Beethoven symphonies were being performed, they would ask and said, look, you know, the third movement of the, you know, the eighth or whatever, said, not very interesting. Could you just do the Allegretto instead from the seventh? They would ask the orchestras to swap it out because this is what people wanted to hear. And then, I don't know about your world, but I cannot go to any dinner party probably for the last 40 years where folks are, let's call it, well-educated, have my kinds of jobs, foodies, have been to Prado and, you know how to pronounce it, right? Those kind of people we all hate, I get it, right? Where Kind of Blue is not on the soundtrack somewhere in the evening, including our house. It's just a signaling to everybody that we get it. We're part of the tribe. He's doing something with modal improvisation, again, hasn't really been done before, and everybody buys it. It's the most popular jazz album ever in history. Why? Because it responds to something in us. It wasn't like 14 billion people just said, oh, I'm having a completely subjective response to modal improvisation by Miles Davis. That's really improbable, right? He is cued into and clued into what we want to hear. And I would say Keith Jarrett, the same thing. One of the things that breaks my heart the most, Keith Jarrett is kind of, you know, the Cohn concert and his standards, and the wonderful improvisational pianist. Doesn't play much anymore. He's got arthritis. But he kind of disavowed the Cohn concert, which is the second largest grossing jazz album in history. He said, well, it was kind of a sophomoric work. I can't really, too melodic. Can't really listen to it anymore. I'm thinking, you just stuck a pin in the ear of like a billion people. Don't do that, you know. And then Pollock to figure up. All right, I got to end on this note. So finally, love and beauty. The quote from Diotima from Plato's Symposium, maybe one of the greatest works ever on love. And the notion of the way love and the beautiful come together is, again, love is hungry, love is desirous, love wants to be fulfilled in some way. And how do you do that? In Plato's / Socrates view, well, you start with a particular. You start with, you know, a person, and you learn love through that. And that leads you successively to understand that really love is a principle, an idea, what he called a form. It's not a particularity. That's immature love. To be in love is to be in love with love as an ideal and to contemplate that. Contra, Plato, I would end on this note. The particularity of love is incredibly important, and it's where love and beauty probably cohere better than any place else. And I'll give you three really quick stories. A long time ago in my life, I set out to become a Christian minister. That was my initial goal once I left undergraduate school. Went to a place in Boston and had an Old Testament Hebrew Bible professor who was objectively unattractive. Just, you know, didn't fulfill any of the golden ratio specs, really, at all. All right. 6-7 weeks into the course, I'm willing to lay down my life for this person, this woman, give up my life, beg and plead her to marry me, and I wasn't alone, everybody else. The beauty of her soul, her passion for what she was doing, her willingness and ability to explain that, her care for each one of us, was something I don't know that I'd ever experienced before. And it took me to a place where literally, I couldn't wait to get in class because she was the most beautiful person I've ever seen. So somewhat contrary to like a lot of the science and our inherent properties, the beauty of the soul, the development, cultivation of the soul, can direct love towards what I might then refer to as true beauty, which she had in spades. Second one, she's not here today, Leslie and her husband, Barry. Barry was my mentor, you know that. Had a kind of relationship, and who knows what goes on, you know, when other people aren't around. But at least to me, as a young person looking at it, they listened each other into a beautiful relationship. The care and seriousness, the deep and depth, deep listening, the depth of listening they had for one another, said, was beautiful. I would leave their house and said, that was a beautiful encounter. They were teaching me something about how to listen to other people that I didn't know. And finally, just to bring it all full circle, I don't know Ira and Val well, and I don't mean to embarrass them in any way, but if you've been to their house, it's a beautiful house. They have curated it immaculately. But far more importantly than that, you go to their house, and it's the same sort of experience. There is a kind of care and cultivation in everything they do, and a warmth between the two of them that you can't help. Well, you don't want to leave. You kind of want to ask them, do you think you could go stay somewhere else and we'll just stay here at your house? So there's a beauty to what they have managed to create, beautiful souls that you can't help be affected by and inspired by. And so the particularity of the beauty in the art, in the person, is something that both inspires and inclines, which I very much appreciate. Thank you.